The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2016 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2016. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at accsedu.org.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for coming. Thank you for being here in Atlanta. I love being in Atlanta. It's my second time here, and basically all I've seen are the hotels that I've been in, but I love being in Atlanta. This is wonderful. My name is Kathy Troyer, and I've been involved in classical Christian education since I was in college. I went to the University of Idaho in Moscow, Idaho, and there was this little tiny school getting started. This was a long time ago, and its name was Logos School. And they met in the basement of a church, and I was able to do some substitute teaching while I was going to school myself and got to know a bunch of people. And eventually, I came back in my adult years and taught there for 10 years. And then I taught at a school in Mesa, Arizona called Providence Classical School. And now I am teaching fifth grade at the Ambrose School in Boise, Idaho. You may not realize it, but actually that's quite a statement for me. You see, when I first applied at Ambrose School, there were several teaching positions open, and fifth grade was the last grade that I wanted to teach. The other fifth grade teacher was young, witty, pretty, creative. Some of you might know her. Her name is Jenny Rollins. Yeah. And so I was convinced that there was no way that I could teach like her, that the way that she taught fifth grade was completely out of my comfort zone. And there was no way that you could teach this old dog new tricks. But I went ahead and said yes, and I'm so grateful to God for putting me there, because I have learned a lot and has made me a much better teacher. One of the reasons for my growth as a teacher was because I learned how to use the great ideas in my teaching. And today I hope to tell you a bit about the great ideas, what they are, give you some examples of them, and then hopefully help you to learn how to incorporate them in your own classroom. So first we have to ask the question, what are the great ideas? And several of you probably know what they are already, but there are probably a few of you that are going, great ideas? Yeah, right. Okay, so like a machine that will fold my laundry for me? You know what? There is such a thing. It's called the Fold-A-Mate, and they're taking pre-orders in 2017. So just go to foldamate.com and get your orders in. Oh, I know. How about a chocolate cake that actually stimulates weight loss? That would be good. Or even better, an ACCS conference held in the Bahamas. That's a great idea. Well, even though these are efficient, delicious, and relaxing great ideas, they are not what we call the great ideas. A simple definition of the great ideas are those ideas that are inherently human. They are ideas that transcend time. We've seen them throughout the periods of history. We've seen them in every generation, and we've seen them in every nation of the world. In literature, we call these great ideas themes. They're the lessons or the truths that are taught within a story. Great ideas resonate with us because they are rooted in God's spiritual laws. These are the laws that God established in His creation. Our hearts and our souls recognize the inherent truth and value of these ideas because they're given to us by God, in whose image we are made. Ideas like love, family, heroism, mortality, and sacrifice. These ring true to us because we've experienced them. We've experienced them in our own lives, or perhaps we've experienced them vicariously through stories of other people's lives. The great ideas are essential tools in classical Christian education for two primary reasons. The first is to provide biblical worldview training and spiritual formation. The great ideas, as I said earlier, are rooted in God's spiritual laws. They present, and also we've experienced them. They present truth, beauty, and goodness to our students in a way that's meaningful and applicable to them. As we teach these ideas, and I tell you, we talk about them all the time, every day in every subject, this gives students daily practice to take the time and the effort to not only identify the great ideas, but also to go past the surface and gain a real deeper understanding of relationships and events in history and in literature. This daily practice of looking at the great ideas helps the students to see them everywhere, and I tell you they do. They see them everywhere. And that then enriches their conversations with their peers and with their parents. I can't tell you how many stories I've heard from parents who've said, we're watching this movie, and all of a sudden my child says, Mother, that's appearance versus reality. Or they're sitting at the dinner table, and they're just talking, and the child will bring up a great idea. Or they're in church, and in a sermon, they'll mention a great idea that they've heard. And all these conversations that happen at home and at church and in the classroom then cultivate the student's character and virtue. The second reason that we use the great ideas, is we use it as a principal tool for subject integration. These are the common thread that weaves throughout all of our discussions in literature and history. We also consider them when we write compositions, when we do public speaking, and we use them as examples in most all the other subjects. The great ideas give us context in our subject. They give us structure in our lesson plans. They give meaning to the material that we're learning. And then that gives relevance to the students' lives. It makes these great ideas applicable and the things that we're teaching applicable to them. So, now that we know what the great ideas are, let's start talking about them. In the fifth grade, we teach them 12 great ideas throughout the year. And the great ideas are always introduced through literature. However, as you'll see later as we talk, that we then talk about them in the other subjects as well. At the Ambrose School, I get the great pleasure of teaching all of Tolkien's books. In literature, we read The Hobbit, and we read all three of the Lord of the Rings books, which is wonderful fodder for the great ideas. We also read some great historical fiction. We read The Witch of Blackbird Pond, and we read Johnny Tremaine. So the first great idea that we introduce in The Hobbit is appearance versus reality. The definition of that is, as you know, sometimes people and circumstances appear to be one way, but in reality, they may be something completely different. For example, in The Hobbit, Gandalf brings a group of dwarves to the home of Bilbo Baggins. And the dwarves are on their way to the Lonely Mountain to get their treasure back from the evil dragon Smaug. And Gandalf has brought them to Bilbo's house because Gandalf has told the dwarves that Bilbo will be their burglar. He'll be the one to steal the treasure back. Well, the dwarves get there and they see that Bilbo is just an ordinary hobbit. And they do not believe that he is capable of being a burglar. And in fact, even Bilbo does not think that he is capable of doing the job. But Gandalf says, there's a lot more in him than you guess, and a deal more than he has any idea of himself. You may, possibly, all live to thank me yet. You see, Gandalf looks beyond the appearance of Bilbo, this ordinary hobbit, and instead he sees the reality of Bilbo's talents and his potential. When we teach this great idea to our students, we want them to see the tensions between what something appears to be and what it is in reality. It's not enough for them just to be able to identify, he appears this way, but in reality that way. Instead, how does that difference affect the story? In this case, the dwarves form this opinion about Bilbo, and that makes them doubt his value to them. And it makes Bilbo doubt his value as well. But Bilbo begins to live up to Gandalf's expectations, which are based on the reality that he sees, and then Bilbo's confidence grows, and ultimately he becomes a very integral part of the success of the quest. This same example leads us to the next great idea, which is being chosen. As I said, Gandalf brings the dwarves to Bilbo, and he tells them, "Let's have no more arguments. I have chosen Mr. Baggins, and that ought to be enough for all of you. If I say he is a burglar he is, or will be when the time comes." Gandalf chooses Bilbo. In this great idea, a character is chosen to do a particular task or to fulfill a mission. Sometimes this happens with a character's assent. Yes, I'd be happy to do that for you. Other times, though, the character is at odds and does not want to be a part of that. Often, as is in Bilbo's case, people are chosen by the will of someone else. Once in a while, sometimes, fate or providence or the circumstances of a situation will choose someone. We know that the students will see this obvious act of someone being chosen, but we want them to delve deeper into the meaning of being chosen by looking at what are the reasons that a character was chosen and what is that character's reaction to being chosen. Do they accept the responsibility that's put on them? Do they fulfill that responsibility? Do they change as a result of taking on that responsibility? We want them to go even further and evaluate what characteristics make a good leader. How do the students choose others to lead them? How can they be a good leader? And for what has God or parents or your teacher chosen for them to do? And will they do it? The third great idea that we introduced is community and fellowship. It's hard for me not to say community and fellowship. That's how my students say it. The definition of community and fellowship is really easy for students to understand and identify. It is a friendship between one or two characters or between one or two groups of characters, such as maybe nations or races. But what's important is it's not just the friendship between these groups, but it's how does that friendship affect the plot or the characters. So that's the tricky thing for the students, is to be able to articulate how does it affect the plot. The example that we're going to look at in The Hobbit is the group is captured by some very monstrous spiders, and they're all wound up in this big web, and they're hanging. And Bilbo, though, is able to get out of his web, and in the process, he kills the spider. Tolkien tells us that afterwards, he felt a different person, and much fiercer and bolder, in spite of an empty stomach, as he wiped his sword on the grass and put it back into its sheath. "I will give you a name," he said to it, "and I shall call you Sting." Then Bilbo has a choice to make. Is he going to use his ring to become invisible and get out of there? Or is he going to stay and help save the other dwarves? He decides to stay, and he draws the spiders away, and then he releases the dwarves. But the reason that he stays is because he is now a member of the company or a member of the community. And This choice that he makes to stay because of that enables the company to stay on their path, to stay on their mission and fulfill their quest. But also, that decision to stay, being a member of that community, affects Bilbo as well. He begins at that point to change from an ordinary hobbit into a very unlikely hero. At this point, we also teach our students the concept of antithesis, which is the opposite of an idea. So the flip side of the community and fellowship coin is lack of community and fellowship. In The Lord of the Rings, there's a point where the company is arguing about something, and Gandalf tells them that if they continue to argue, that that is one of Sauron's greatest weapons, this lack of community and fellowship among Sauron's enemies. And so he convinces them that we need to pull together and continue on. The fourth great idea is an idea, a term that is coined by Tolkien himself. It is eucatastrophe. Repeat that with me, please. Eucatastrophe. Good job. I tell my students, after I teach this to them, you need to go home now and say, "Mommy, Daddy, I just experienced a terrible eucatastrophe today." Literally, eucatastrophe means good catastrophe. And this is what happens. Something bad happens, something horrible, terrible. That's our catastrophe. But the resolution of that catastrophe actually makes things better than had the catastrophe never happened. It's not just enough to be saved, but the salvation part of it needs to make things even better than had the bad thing never happened. We introduce this when, in The Hobbit, when the company has been chased by wargs and goblins into these trees, and Gandalf has been throwing fireballs at the wargs, but unfortunately now the trees have caught fire and are working their way up, and the company is about to be completely consumed by the fire. And Gandalf has to do something. Then Gandalf climbed to the top of this tree. The sudden splendor flashed from his wand like lightning as he got ready to spring down from on high, right among the spears of the goblins. But he never leaped. Just at that moment, the Lord of the Eagles swept down from above, seized him in his talons, and was gone. So in the midst of this catastrophe, the eagles swooped down and saved them. Yay! And yet that's not your catastrophe. What makes it a eucatastrophe is the fact that the eagles then take them to their eyrie, give them food, give them rest, and have taken them farther along the journey in one day than they could have gotten on foot. So as you see, it turns out better than had the catastrophe never happened. We want to encourage students to see eucatastrophe in their own lives. We want them to see how God works all things together for good. And we want, because that will then kindle thankfulness and praise to God. Self-sacrifice, the fifth great idea, involves a character or a group of characters giving up something for the benefit of others. Obviously, that could mean sacrificing one's life, but it could also mean sacrificing your time, sacrificing your possessions, sacrificing friendships, perhaps sacrificing your reputation. There's many things that we can give up. This self-sacrifice in stories usually causes two things. One, events are changed for the better. And two, the character himself will grow. And self-sacrifice is often a part of other great ideas. Eucatastrophe almost always involves self-sacrifice. And community and fellowship usually motivates self-sacrifice. We usually give things up for people that we care about. Self-sacrifice, again, is easy for students to identify in a story, but like the other great ideas, how does it affect the plot beyond just that moment? In the mines of Moria, the group is being pursued by orcs. They're underground and they're trying to go through this mountain, and these orcs are coming along and they're running over this bridge that is going over a huge chasm. And all of a sudden, this Balrog, and all my students are like, "What's a Balrog? What's a Balrog?" I don't know. It's just this horrible monster. But this Balrog is attacking them. And the only way that the company can survive, Gandalf determines, is for him to fight the Balrog. He's the only one that has the capabilities of doing that. So Gandalf attacks the Balrog. "Over the bridge!" cried Gandalf, recalling his strength. "Fly! This is a foe beyond any of you. I must hold the narrow way. Fly!" He fights the Balrog. The Balrog falls, and as he falls, his tail lashes around, grabs hold of Gandalf, and pulls him down into the chasm to his death. This, obviously, is the epitome of self-sacrifice. This is the giving up of one's life for others. But this also affects the plot because it motivates the others then to finish the quest. They can't give up now that Gandalf's given up his life. So they continue on. And it forces Aragorn to take the role, take on that responsibility as the leader of the quest, the leader of the company. Another one of our great ideas is providence and will. Providence and will centers around the question, does God or some other form of fate determine our every move? That's providence. Or do we make choices that determine the path of our life? That's will. Within a story, we determine, is it the characters that are making choices that propel the action? Or is providence or fate controlling the action? Or are both working together in the situation? There are obvious times when things just happen. We can just see that something just happens. But there are equally times when characters make choices, whether they are good choices or bad choices. Additionally, there are times when circumstances and choices work hand in hand. Tolkien seems to say in The Lord of the Rings that providence and will work together in the destruction of the ring. Frodo was chosen, fate, providence, at the Council of Elrond to take the ring to Mount Doom. Elrond says, "He is the bearer, and the fate of the burden is on him. I do not think that it is our part to drive him one way or the other, nor do I think that we should succeed if we tried. There are other powers at work, far stronger." But it's also clear that Frodo volunteers to take the ring. And there are many times along the quest where he makes the choice to continue on the quest, because he's tempted many times to not go, to give up. Without his determination and will, he would never have made it to Mount Doom. And even once he gets there, he's gone all the way. He's where he's supposed to be. He's supposed to take the ring and throw it into the cracks of Doom. He chooses not to. He chooses to keep the ring. But fate steps in. And Gollum, who has been kept alive all this time, for some reason or other, he takes the ring. Actually, he bites Frodo's finger off. Takes the ring, which is his will, but then tumbles into the chasm and the ring is destroyed against Gollum's will. So you see there how providence and will, the choices and fate, both work together in the destruction of the ring. The seventh great idea is hope versus despair. Hope propels people to undertake things that are important, but perhaps difficult to do. Even seemingly impossible feats will be attempted if there's the slightest chance that they might succeed. Despair, on the other hand, can not only impede a task, but it may also destroy the soul of the person who's attempting it. in Return of the King, Denethor's despair over the apparent overthrow of Gondor leads him to forsake his people. They come to him and say, Denethor, Denethor, please, we're being attacked. And Denethor says, we're all going to die anyway. This might as well go burn. He also sends Faramir on a suicide task, a suicide quest. That's his son. Sends him off to where he thinks he's going to die. And then eventually, Denethor commits suicide because of his despair. Gandalf, on the other hand, has hope in the future of Middle-earth. His hope is in the quest of Frodo and Sam. He believes that they can destroy the ring and save Middle-earth. He's so sure that this could happen that he actually gathers forces from Gondor and leads them to their own parent's suicide mission. However, this is based on hope, not despair. And they're doing that in order to draw Sauron's eye away from Frodo and Sam so they can get into Mordor and destroy the ring. We want to emphasize with our students, from where or from whom does their hope come from? And in what or in whom should they put their hope? So where does their hope come from and who should they put their hope in? And you all know the answer, right? God. Despair, too, we need to teach them, always ends in death. But hope gives life to our dreams, to our endeavors, and to our souls. The next great idea is do the right thing. This is when characters make a choice that seems to them the right thing to do. But it's more complicated than that. They may choose to do the right thing, they may choose to do the wrong thing, or they may choose to do nothing at all. In the Two Towers, at the end of the Two Towers, Samwise Gamgee, my very favorite character of The Lord of the Rings. However, I will not tell my students that till the last day of the last book, because they ask all the time, who's your favorite character? Ooh, you're going to have to wait. But it's Samwise Gamgee. He has to make a choice at the end of Two Towers. He has to decide to either stay with Frodo, who appears to be mortally wounded, or he needs to take the ring from Frodo and continue on the quest. This is a very, very difficult decision for Sam to make, because he loves his master. It's just part of his soul to stay with his master. He has to decide, am I going to stay faithful to Frodo, or am I going to stay faithful to the quest? And he says, what am I to do then? Sam cried again, and now he seemed plainly to know the hard answer. See it through. Another long journey, and the worst. That's not for me to go taking the ring, putting myself forward. But you haven't put yourself forward. You've been put forward. He decides to finish the quest, which ultimately shows faithfulness to both Frodo and the quest. We know that our students want to do the right thing, right? So we want to reinforce that desire in them to do the right thing, even when it's not the easiest thing to do, and it rarely is. We also want to teach students to recognize the choices that are before a character and how the consequences of their choices affect the plot. Also, how their consequences affect other people, other characters, and how those choices affect themselves. Had Sam chosen to stay with Frodo, the ring may not have been destroyed, and Mordor may have been overwhelmed by Sauron. We want our students to make right choices, and we want them to encourage the other classmates to make right choices as well. But we also want our students to understand the difficulties in making that right choice, and we want them to understand how to show grace and forgiveness to those people who fail to make the right choice. The ninth great idea death and resurrection sometimes involve a literal death and resurrection, like Jesus dying on the cross, resurrecting, and like Gandalf. But more often, it involves a metaphorical death and resurrection. Common types of death are sleep, injuries, broken relationships, material losses, failures, death of a friendship, death of a career, the death of a dream, the death of a bank account. Resurrection, though, comes in the form of a new beginning or a transformation into something else, or a gain, waking up, a home run, a butterfly coming out of a chrysalis, healing from an illness, the birth of a child. Those are all metaphorical forms of resurrection. In The Return of the King, Aragorn leaves Rohan to travel to Gondor to fight the forces of Mordor. But he chooses to go through the paths of the dead, which appropriately lead underground through a type of tomb. And all the people have given up hope of ever seeing him again because no one ever comes back from the paths of the dead. However, Aragorn emerges from the dark. He emerges from the paths, and he arrives in Gondor in a ship. Gondor's arrival, this resurrection, gave hope and physical support to the forces of Rohan and Gondor and enabled them to defeat their enemy. I have a question for you. How did you first learn about good and evil? Right and wrong? It was most likely through stories. Those of fearless knights and evil dragons, or brave boys and nasty pirates, or innocent girls and maniacal mistresses, to name just a few. Stories, our next great idea, are the way that we learn best. Our history is passed down through stories, songs, and poems of the events that shaped our nation and our character. God uses story through his word, through the Psalms, through the Gospels. Jesus taught the crowd through parables. The Creator God brought the whole world into being with just a word. He gave us his word so that we could learn more about him. We want to teach our students not only how to identify a story, a song, or a poem within literature, but more importantly, what is that story, that song, that poem teaching us? And how do those things affect the plot or the character? In The Fellowship of the Ring, Merry and Pippin are stuck in the roots of an old willow tree that is dragging them inside the roots of himself. Frodo and Sam are crying for help, calling for help, and help comes, but it comes in the form of a boisterous, odd man named Tom Bombadil. Tom Bombadil sings and demands that the willow tree let them go. "You let them out again, old man Willow," he said. "What be you a-thinking of? You should not be waking. Eat earth. Dig deep. Drink water. Go to sleep. Bombadil is talking." Tom uses story or the power of words rather than force to free Merry and Pippin from the trees. This is an opportunity for us to highlight to our students the power that words have. They have the power to build others up. They also have the power to tear people down. They have the power to deny God or to praise him. Our 11th grade idea is faith and reason. This shows up when a character has to make a choice between acting on faith or doing what seems to make sense to them at the time. In The Two Towers, Frodo and Sam have been followed by Gollum. who is known to be a very treacherous and murderous creature. Gollum then is found by Faramir at the Forbidden Pool in Ithilien. Faramir gives Frodo the opportunity to have Gollum killed. This is very reasonable because, first of all, it's a punishment. Nobody is allowed at the Forbidden Pool without permission, otherwise they're killed. And, of course, Gollum may harm them, may get in their way. But Gandalf, much earlier, advised Frodo against killing Gollum. The creature is wretched and hungry, said Frodo, and unaware of his danger. And Gandalf, your Mithrandir, he would have bidden you not to slay him for that reason, and for others. He forbade the elves to do so. I do not know clearly why, but this creature is in some way bound up with my errand. So Frodo shows faith in Gandalf. He chooses what the faithful choice is, and he spares Gollum's life. Now, as we know, had he had him killed, the ring would never have been destroyed. We need to teach our students that when we apply faith and reason to biblical faith, we know that the world values reason above all. In fact, the world would say that faith in God is not reasonable. But ultimately, it's important for our students to see that having faith in God is the most reasonable thing. The last of our 12 great ideas is light versus darkness. In most literature, including scripture, light is synonymous with good and darkness is synonymous with evil. We have the dark night, who is always a bad night, and the white night, that is always the good night. In Westerns, don't always the bad guys wear black hats and the good guys wear white hats and ride on pale-colored steeds? Well, in The Lord of the Rings, Mordor and Sauron's armies are always described using dark metaphors. In fact, in The Return of the King, we see that this dark cloud begins to spread all over Middle-earth as Sauron is gaining more and more power and control. And real dawn never comes. Whenever the dawn comes, they just talk about it as being a little bit of a lightening of the darkness, but there's never any real light. But as the riders of Rohan arrive to fight for Gondor, just as a cock crows and the first flush of dawn appears, then hope comes as well. We want the students to look for physical light and darkness in stories, but we want them to see how it's tied to symbolic good and evil. Light versus darkness can also be tied to other great ideas, in particular, death and resurrection. We saw that with Aragorn going into the dark paths of the dead and coming out in these ships to the lights of Gondor. And it's also connected to hope and despair, just as we saw here. Hope comes to the men of Gondor and Rohan to Gondor as the armies of Rohan appear. So we want the students to see how does an author use light and darkness to both describe things, but also to symbolize things. And what are they symbolizing? Okay. Now that we've defined and identified all 12 of the great ideas that we teach in fifth grade, and you might come up with others that are in your literature, let's look at some specific ways that I use these as tools in the classroom. I start off the first day of the school year telling the students, guess what we're going to learn this year? We're going to learn the great ideas, and they are so amazing and so wonderful. And this creates anticipation in my class. They're all excited. Oh, the great news. What are we going to learn? You just wait. But they're going to be so good. So you just kind of get them excited about it before you even teach it to them. They are always introduced through literature, through story, which is one of the great ideas, right? But to do this, we need to teach the students to go deep in literature. We're not just reading just for the plot. We have to look for these great ideas. And the technique that I use to do that is guided active reading. What I do is, when we're reading Tolkien, students have their books open. I read aloud, and they follow along in their book. We go through all of the books that way. I read them aloud, and they follow in the book. But I stop periodically to ask questions. Might just be a comprehension question, might be an inference question, might be an application type of question. Or we'll stop to appreciate some sort of description or identify tropes. And this is also the time when I will stop and introduce a great idea, or we'll ponder on a great idea that we've already learned. When I first heard about this technique, I thought, fifth grade reading books aloud to fifth graders? That's not teaching reading. But then I thought through it, and I thought, well, what actually is reading? Is it teaching phonics to sound out words? Is it the understanding of words? Is it the comprehension of a plot? Is it fluent oral reading? Well, yes, those are all important steps in reading. But I think that the truest sense of reading, the goal that we're reaching for as we're teaching children how to read, is for them to think while they read and to be affected by what they read. So to that end, I guide the students through the reading, and they follow along. And we actively think, and we actively discuss what we encounter in the books. And, Lord willing, the students will learn something and then be changed by that knowledge. An example of using guided active reading is when I first introduced appearance versus reality, which is the first grade idea. We have been talking about Bilbo. We've been introduced to him. We'll discuss what he's like. But then we start to see Bilbo change. And we talk about how he's changing. And then I announce, well, this is our first grade idea. It's appearance versus reality. And I explain to them what appearance versus reality is. But that then allows me the opportunity now to ask questions like, as we're reading along, what great idea do you see right here? I'll be reading something and stop. What great idea is this? What do you think this is? Or maybe I'll ask, can you give me an example of appearance versus reality in this section? And then they have to give me the example. Eventually, students are volunteering. Oh, Mr. and Mrs. George, I just saw Providence and Will. You're right. They see it all on their own. And as I introduce great ideas, I keep a list on my board of all the great ideas, and that's just for great handy reference. When I ask that question, what great idea do you see? And they'll say one, I'll go, no, that's not quite it. And then you see the kids looking up and down the list. Oh, which one's going to be? And sometimes we have to narrow it down after I've said no about six times. Another time that we use the great ideas is in formal discussions. These are one of the master skills that we teach in the fifth grade. The great ideas are our topics for our formal discussions. One of the topics might be, give examples of each of the great ideas that we find in the two towers. And they'll bring up a great idea. We'll discuss that for a bit. They'll bring up another great idea. We discuss that. Or I might ask, which character shows the greatest amount of self-sacrifice in this book? They'll bring up one character and here are all the reasons I think it's this one. Another character will discuss all of those reasons, etc. The goal in formal discussions is that we want the great ideas to become supports for all of their assertions that they make in their discussions. When we ask the question, what would be a tragic result for the elves of destroying the ring? Is it worth the cost? Why or why not? I want them to eventually bring up self-sacrifice, community and fellowship, faith and reason. If not, then I need to lead them to bringing those great ideas up. Another skill that we learn in the fifth grade is commonplacing. This is when you write important quotes from a book into a beautifully bound book. And this is for future review and ruminating. All of our commonplacing, I'm sure many, if not all of you, do commonplace in your classrooms, but our center around the great ideas. All of our quotes from the book are ones that show a great idea, or several, as you see up there. I'll start off the year by giving the students the quotes, and then I'll ask, what great idea does this show? And they'll let me know. The second step that we make is I'll then say, okay, now I want you to find a commonplace that shows appearance versus reality. And they've got to find that nugget, that's the word I use, they've got to find that nugget, that most important part of the quote that shows that great idea. And then the third step, the goal by the end of the year, is that I want the students then to be able to find their own commonplaces for the great ideas. And these commonplaces become important supports or important sources for the supports in their formal discussions, for any presentations that they do, for written compositions, and are vital for our final presentations that I'll tell you about a little bit later. After we read the Fellowship of the Ring, we participate in an oral final. And this is another opportunity for us to go deep. I ask the students to find an example and commonplaces for all the great ideas that we've studied in the Fellowship of the Ring. And they need to be able to describe the example, tell me how does it illustrate the great idea, why is it important, and then they need to apply that great idea to their own life. And this application is the important next step in teaching the great ideas. This is the point when the ideas begin to have an effect on the students' lives and character. This oral final, and that's not really an oral final going on, but I didn't have a picture of one, but you get the idea, one parent, one student, right? Or excuse me, one teacher, one student. An oral final is an excellent way for a teacher to connect with their students and to make learning more collaborative because you're doing this one-on-one. Students are scared to death when you first tell them this is what you're going to do. However, once they sit down, you start talking with them, they quickly find out that you're just having a chat with them, that you're not going to sit there and take notes and just ask questions, that you're actually discussing something together. And after I've gone through the first two or three oral finals, I'll have those students get up in class and tell all the other students, easy piece of cake, it's actually fun, and they enjoy it. Okay, so the great ideas are introduced in literature, but they're also a tool for integration, as I said earlier. And one of the ways that we integrate them is we integrate our literature with art through the great ideas. And the first way that we do that is through our Hobbit final project. The Hobbit final project shows a great idea for each of the 19 chapters in The Hobbit. Give students 3x5 cards, which they fold in half, and on the outside, they draw an illustration of some event that happened in that chapter, along with the title of the chapter. And then inside, they write the great idea and a short explanation of an example of that great idea. And then these Hobbit final projects hang up on the wall outside our classroom for most all the rest of the school year. Another art project that we connect with the great ideas is the Two Towers travel brochure. We have the students choose a region. They can choose Fanghorn, Rohan, Helm's Deep, Hnes Anun, Ithilien, or Isengard before Sauron got a hold of it. Saruman, before he got a hold of it. Inside the brochure, you see there's some pictures that they draw of the area. They write descriptive paragraphs. But on the right-hand side, this is where they're going to write a paragraph about a great idea that represents that particular region. And they also then have to have a commonplace that will support that great idea from the book. All right. We also use great ideas when we're teaching composition. Some of our written essays are about the great ideas. We do a three-paragraph essay where the students have to give examples of the great ideas in the Fellowship of the Ring. We do oral declamations, which are short speeches, usually 30 to 60 seconds. They're really short. But these declamations revolve around characters, namely in Johnny Tremaine and in the Two Towers. And they'll get up and talk about the character, but they also, in that description of the character, have to tell us how they reflect a particular great idea. And they need to use commonplaces for support. Do you see a theme going along there? They keep using commonplaces for support. Also, we don't do many worksheets in literature. Most of our teaching in literature is through discussion. But sometimes we'll have what we call a long answer question on a worksheet. And that's a question where they have to be much more thorough in answering it, much more thoughtful in coming up with the answer. One of the examples from Fellowship of the Ring is we ask, what great idea is most prevalent when Strider is mentioned? And they can't just say appearance versus reality, which is the answer. But we want them to tell how. What does he appear like at the beginning? What is he in reality? How do we see that come about? What do Frodo and Sam think about Strider at the beginning and then later when they find out more about him? You know, they just need to be very thoughtful about this whole great idea and be very thorough in telling us about it. We also talk about the great ideas in Bible because we are able, in fifth grade, we read through the Gospels, so we get to use story in Bible. And we do our daily readings through the Gospels. And I'll tell you, the great ideas just naturally come up in our discussions because it's something we talk about all day long in all the subjects. We talk about Christ's death on the cross and his resurrection. We talk about how his death is the ultimate example of self-sacrifice and that his death was motivated by love, community, and his desire for fellowship with us. We talk about Thomas's lack of faith and his desire for reasonable proof. We discuss how the disciples despaired when Christ was nailed on the cross, but how they were given eternal hope when they saw their risen Savior. We discuss how the Gospels are the epitome of story and the epitome of a eucatastrophe. History, another story, is ripe with examples of the great ideas. We study the exploration period, the pilgrims, the whole colonization, and the early War for Independence, and a little bit of Lewis and Clark, that sort of thing. We talk about with Columbus that his life, there's a catastrophe in his life. He is shipwrecked, and he's the lone survivor of this shipwreck. And he just happens, which is also providence, right? He just happens to wash up on the shores of Portugal where his brother lives. And it's also the nucleus of the exploration period. The navigational school is there. And so that allows him then to learn about exploration and have that desire to go. We discuss how we're studying the pilgrims, how the Native Americans show community and fellowship to the pilgrims by teaching them how to plant corn. We also ask the question, was it the right thing for the colonists to declare war against the mother country? So is it the right thing? Is it the wrong thing? And we talk about people choosing sides. And the great idea should just naturally come up in all the other subjects. In English, we use examples from our literature books for our sentences that we work on. In math, the great ideas came up. I have to tell you the story because it warms my heart. And I was teaching how to multiply positive and negative integers. And, you know, when you multiply two positive integers, you get a positive answer. When you multiply two negative integers, you get a positive answer. But when you multiply a positive and a negative integer, you get a negative answer. And one year, my student raised her hand. She said, Mrs. Troyer, that's community and fellowship. When the integers are the same, it's a positive thing. And when they have lack of community and fellowship, it's a negative thing. I'm like, thank you, Lord. It was wonderful. So obviously the great ideas are taught in subjects, but they're also reflected in our classroom liturgies. We have a charter in our classroom. This, rather than having a set list of rules for the class, this charter describes the behaviors that the students agree to abide to. They sign the charter on the first day. Our overall great idea is community and fellowship, the overall one in our class. And the charter will tell us, it says, well, there's several great ideas that are also represented in the charter. It says, I will love my God. I will love my parents by honoring my teachers. I'll love my fellow students by serving and making friends. These are all examples of community and fellowship. They say, I will delight in the world God has made and the story he is telling by enjoying and contemplating the natural world, history, and art made by people who are made in God's image. Just a story. I will be honest by telling the truth and doing my schoolwork all on my own. It's an example of do the right thing. And there are many others. Another daily liturgy that we engage in is a class motto. We do this every day. And the class motto goes like this. With my whole strength, God's gifts and heart, I'll love the Lord and heed his call. From light of dawn till breath departs, I'll love and serve my neighbors all. This reflects community and fellowship. Love the Lord, love my neighbors, do the right thing, I'll heed God's call. Light versus darkness, the light of dawn till breath departs, which is symbolizing from birth until death. And providence and will, the choice of deciding to do this. We usually do this as a responsorial. Either I start it and they answer, or I'll have different groups do it. There's one time I said, okay, all of you blonde-haired students, you start, and everybody else repeat, and that sort of thing. The great ideas are also useful tools in class management. Pretty early in the school year, I divide the students into pods, and I call them colonies. And those colonies can either earn or lose points for their behavior inside and outside of the classroom. And this colony experience is the embodiment of the great idea of community. And they've got to learn, how do I work in a community? How do I get along with each other? Because if they don't, they're not going to earn points and get that candy bar at the end of the quarter, right? They also need to learn, how am I just going to solve problems between my classmates and me? They use self-sacrifice. I have to give up my desires to talk when I'm not supposed to for the good of the community. They experience do the right thing because every day they've got to make a choice whether they're going to behave in a way that will help them to earn points and benefit the entire colony, or are they going to do the easier thing and not have any self-control. I'm constantly bringing up the great ideas when I'm disciplining or training the entire class or individuals. It's just a part of our vocabulary. The great ideas, like I said, we discuss them daily, all the time. I might ask them questions like, what does it take to be a member of your community? How do you treat others in the community who aren't easy to get along with or who maybe aren't easy to like? What is the best right thing that you can do in this situation? You know, those are probably the two we bring up the most, are community and fellowship and do the right thing when we're talking about classroom discipline. And this is also a time when you want to discuss confession, repentance, and restitution in this whole idea of doing the right thing. These past few examples that I've given to you have to do with real life, which is our story. And this is the goal that we want to reach with our students. We want them in literature, history, and Bible to be able to relate to the characters and to feel this personal connection with them in order for them to experience real life-changing lessons. And we can do that.